From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Quote, few African countries have followed a more disappointing trajectory over the past two decades than Zimbabwe. Once a model of democracy, law, and tolerance, this nation is becoming a fearful, militarized autocracy. President Robert Mugabe's latest diatribes against journalists and judges are particularly troubling. That's from a New York Times editorial in 1999. Fast forward a decade to the Zimbabwe of today.
Zimbabwe has banned foreign journalists from covering this election and its aftermath. We're not sure how alert they are to journalists trying to cross here, but we do know they've arrested several journalists, both foreigners and Zimbabweans.
Robert Mugabe was sworn in yesterday following a campaign of violence and voter intimidation.
Government thugs are now hunting down Zimbabweans who can't prove they voted for Mugabe.
Zimbabwe is no longer, as the Times put it back then, sliding into tyranny. A most brutal dictatorship has long since arrived. Only now, the diatribes against journalists, political opponents, and others have turned into jailings, beatings, and worse. Freelance correspondent Joshua Hammer wrote about Zimbabwe recently for the New York Review of Books. He says the country began its dramatic descent back in 2000 when President Mugabe initiated a so-called land reform program, seizing thousands of farms from white Zimbabweans and giving the land to friends and cronies with virtually no farming experience at all.
The economy collapsed. Unemployment rose to staggering levels, foreign exchange dried up, health and education and virtually every sector of society began a steep, dramatic downward slide into the near chaos and total destitution that we have today.
So amid all this chaos comes the election back in the spring, an election Mugabe clearly lost to Democratic opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. Then what happened?
Well, Mugabe and his henchmen did not like the result. According to the terms of the election, Tsvangirai and Mugabe had to participate in a runoff, and the ruling party under Mugabe embarked on the most vicious, brutal campaign of torture and killings and intimidation to cow the opposition and to guarantee Mugabe a victory in this farce of an election that took place last week.
One of the quirks of this period of brutality is that it was widely reported in the West, excuse the expression, pretty much blow by blow. What about the Zimbabweans themselves? Were they kept apprised of the situation by the domestic media?
The dominant newspaper in the country is the Herald, which is a ruling party mouthpiece that has no credibility whatsoever. There are two opposition newspapers that come out once a week. They reach a very small English-language audience, so have really sort of negligible effect, other than to give people like you and me and Western journalists a non-rantingly pro-Mugabe perspective. Then there's the state-owned television network, which effectively has made Morgan Tsvangirai and the opposition a non-person, and state-owned radio, which does the same thing. So the options for people who are, say, out in the bush, rural areas in Zimbabwe, to get any sort of media information other than what is spoon-fed to them by the ruling party, by the ZANU-PF, is really negligible.
Now, tell me about the foreign press. You were in Zimbabwe immediately before the election, but were not traveling there with a journalist visa. You entered as a tourist. Tell me about just the mechanics for a foreign correspondent of reporting there.
It's still, believe it or not, reasonably easy to cross over from the Zambian border, Victoria Falls, posing as a tourist. You get stamped at the border, you pay your 20 or 30 U.S. dollars, and you're in. Once you get into the country, you have to avoid the big hotels that are hangouts for the Central Intelligence Organization, Mugabe's secret police. You have to travel around with people who know areas to avoid, who know what's safe. Surprisingly, you can still work under the radar screen. I've been noticing the reporting of a colleague of mine for Newsweek who's managed to do some pretty astonishing reporting over the last week, clearly moving around clandestinely.
I gather that at this stage of the game, Robert Mugabe has no interest or probably even fear about what the Western press has to say. This slide into absolute repression has occurred with vilification from the entire Western world, and, you know, it hasn't seemed to hindered him in the least.
Actually, this is the theme that I'm going to address in an essay in the New York Review of Books this week. What effect, if any, do the Western press, do sanctions from the West, do the constant outspoken criticism of people like Prime Minister Gordon Brown of Great Britain, and to some extent now a couple of African leaders, which has been basically unheard of in the past, what effect does this all have on this ruthless, savage regime? I'm afraid to say that the answer is very little. A dictator like Mugabe, who still has access to a couple of countries that are willing to do business with him, such as China and such as South Africa, can basically do whatever he pleases. The only way to get rid of a guy like Mugabe, I'm afraid to say, is assassination or military intervention.
Or God. The man is 84 years old.
Or God. Whichever comes first.
Josh, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Josh Hammer has been writing about the crisis in Zimbabwe for the New York Review of Books. The African Union summit closed on Tuesday. Leaders who met in Egypt talked about Zimbabwe's presidential problem. They also talked about Africa's food problem. The World Bank estimates that rising food costs will create, quote, a daily struggle for more than 2 billion people and threaten to push some 100 million people into poverty. Analysts agree the problem hits Africans particularly hard. Meanwhile, aid agencies are moving tons of U.S. food aid into North Korea. The world's largest retailer, Walmart, announced it will be buying more produce from local growers in order to cut down on shipping costs. Investigators from the Food and Agriculture Organization and the UN have touched down in Pakistan to study that country's food crisis. And World Bank Group President Robert Zoellick called on G8 leaders and oil producers to act now, saying the world is entering a danger zone regarding food and energy prices. Far from fad diets and Rachel Ray, food has become the political and economic issue. Paul Roberts, author of The End of Food, is here to assess whether American journalists are ready to cover it. First, are reporters even using the right terms? What do we mean when we say food crisis?
The most immediate definition is that prices are a lot higher than they were even a year ago. In places where they're spending, 70% and 80% of their household dollars on food, a doubling and tripling of the price of rice and corn and wheat is disastrous. Kind of more broadly, we've got issues of populations that aren't just getting bigger but are wealthy enough to eat more meat, which, because it's so resource intensive, geometrically increases the demand for grain. You throw in a drought in Australia, poor crop in Canada, and on top of that, you throw in, the new demand for biofuels, and you really have this perfect storm that really caught the world by surprise, or at least the Western world, where we kind of thought hunger had been taken care of.
Now, before I make the decision for all of the media to allocate more resources at a time of dramatic retrenchment in the news business, tell me how critical is the crisis. Is this a transitory event, or is this an issue that is likely to bedevil the world for the foreseeable future?
I think it is a long-term and very complex problem. It's not going to be resolved soon. It's not going to resolve itself by some, market magic. And I think that it's going to become, in terms of a journalistic discipline, it's going to become the beat of the future. So we're going to have a long time to perfect our skills reporting on this.
Periodically, we'll see food safety stories in the U.S. press, and we occasionally see coverage of genetically modified foods. But at least until recently, you just had never seen anything to do with the food supply. Is there any infrastructure in the media for covering the economy of food?
There isn't really a level of expertise or a discipline that centers on food. To the extent that food is covered in the media, it's primarily about kind of in the Martha Stewart vein. It's about cooking shows, it's diet, it's nutrition. Food safety, of course, in the past 2 years has become an issue, and there's been sort of a surge in the development of expertise among journalists and a lot of good writing, finally, about food safety. But, you're right, what we haven't come to grips with yet until recently has been the notion that we might be short of food. And that's, I think, taking a while for the media to really get its head around.
If journalists in the United States are kind of lagging on this subject, is there an example elsewhere in the world where people are covering the crisis exactly right?
I don't know if anyone's covering exactly right. I think the Europeans, they're in the middle of a lot of these issues, so they've had more experience. Regardless of whether you're in Europe or the U.S., the media really, its sort of experience in terms of reporting on food crises has been focusing on regional food crises. It's sub-Saharan Africa. Back in the 70s, it was India. So those were local dysfunction. It was bad policy. It was corruption. And what's new, very new and significant about the current crisis is that it's global. It's affecting everyone, although not to the same degree. And it's being driven in part by policies of industrialized governments. So, and I think reporters and policymakers alike need to get up to speed on the science, but we also need to have the confidence to not allow the stakeholders to frame the issue themselves.
I'm glad you raised the issue of what exactly the press should be doing, because there's really kind of two ways to cover a story like this. You know, 5 or 6 day series, and you give it a title, Hungry for Solutions or some such. The other way to cover a story is to create beats and to bring various disciplines of economics and science and politics to bear on an ongoing story. Is there any evidence that that second path is being followed by anybody?
Yes, there is evidence. In the same way that oil is now a beat, I think food is going to emerge. It's probably going to be some of the same reporters because they will have developed some expertise in reporting on resources, on commodities markets, on financial complexities of commodities generally, and it won't be too hard to make the jump. I mean, energy is energy, you know, whether it's calories or kilowatts. I look at papers like the New York Times is actually doing a pretty good job. It's got an ongoing series. I believe it's the food chain. They just did this great story on how hedge funds are now investing in farm infrastructure and kind of asking, well, is that good or bad? So the fact that a mainstream news organization is not only alerting us to the fact that this is going on, but is starting to examine it critically is a really encouraging sign.
Paul, thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You're welcome.
Paul Roberts is the author of, most recently, The End of Food. Coming up, evangelical numbers are shrinking, and Rush Limbaugh makes more money than, well, certainly than me. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Barack Obama gave a speech about religion in which he pledged to increase funding to George Bush's faith-based initiatives by $500 million. There was much speculation about whether it was shrewd political calculation to woo ever-important evangelical values voters. It's repeated widely that 1 in 4 Americans are evangelical, so it made sense for Christine Wicker, a former religion reporter for the Dallas Morning News, to write a book about this huge, unified portion of the country. But as she started doing research, she was told over and over by evangelicals that she was writing the wrong book and that she should instead investigate how evangelical churches were in fact shrinking. She went on to find a group that was anything but unified. Oh, and that business about evangelicals being a quarter of the population? She says it's wrong.
What's right is that they are 7% of the population. I judged this every way that I could. I looked at beliefs, I looked at behavior, I looked at church attendance, and that 7% holds up every way you look at it. There's only a small core of people, and they are the ones delivering the vote. That other 18%, it's a swing vote.
Even evangelicals often have trouble agreeing on who's who, who's born again, who's evangelical, who's fundamentalist. As a practical political matter, though, versus a theological one, isn't there enough ideology overlap among all of these categories to make the number of certified evangelicals kind of besides the point? I mean, whoever they were, did they not fuel the so-called Republican Revolution, and did they not sweep George W. Bush into power?
Well, Southerners have been voting Republican since Nixon. Now, once Bush came in, he began to convince us that that group of evangelicals was much larger than it was. But here's how I usually answer that question. If that 7% were really as influential and big as we have been led to believe it is, if it was 1 out of 4 Americans, they would have gotten their policies passed, because politicians would be falling all over themselves. So abortion should be illegal by now. Gay rights should have been pushed back. Taxes to help the poor, social programs, all the things that they wanted should be the law of the land. But they're not.
It's not just that it's all out there and the media missed it. To use your word, we've been duped into thinking that this juggernaut was just going to roll over the body politic, outlawing abortion and same-sex marriage and criminalizing Halloween or whatever. How did that happen?
Well, first of all, what they did was to intimidate the press. When you start researching this, you see that they were very deliberate about a whole lot of things. They went into the mainline churches and they fomented dissent. And they accused those churches of being soft on communism. It was a concentrated campaign to use the media to besmirch these other churches. And it worked. We did it. Then they did a campaign to say the media is so liberal that they are against us. Against them, we covered them three times more than we covered anybody else. The media has been a complete lapdog for the religious right.
You hit on an interesting point because the media do tend to be enablers in the cult of personality. There's a handful of people who we seem to have anointed as spokesmen for Christian America, the late Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, James Dobson, Ralph Reed. Is that a big part of the problem?
There's statistics in the book. They asked evangelicals, do you even know who these people are? And most of them didn't. They didn't even know their names. They had no idea who they were. Let's just talk about something that recently came out about James Dobson. He sent out 1 million emails asking his followers who had signed up for these emails. These are core folks. They want to get his message. They want to follow him. He asked them to put their name on a petition asking President Bush not to allow taxpayers' money to be used to fund abortion providers like Planned Parenthood. Now, that's easy. It's their core issue. It's not asking much. He sent out 1 million. He got a 3% return rate. That's pretty good for an email solicitation, but that was not spam. That was sent to people who really are his followers, 1 million of them. Now, if you say James Dobson has 1 million followers, that's real different than saying James Dobson can get 30,000 people to put their names on a petition.
Now, ordinarily, I would never get into issues of personal faith. But in this case, more or less to preserve your credibility, can you tell me something about your personal history with Christianity?
My family is going into its sixth generation of evangelical faith. It is true that I am no longer an evangelical, but for me, that kind of faith is really bred in the bone. And there are many stories of astonishing faith in this book. I think this is a faith that offers a tremendous amount to people. And one of the things that I discovered as I did this book was how much it's still the good things that I learned, the example of Jesus still rules my life very much.
One final thing. If the disintegration of the evangelical movement is going on as you've described, what are the political implications for the 2008 election?
I think that that 7% will never go Democratic, but the 18% is and always has been a swing vote. So what John McCain has to do is keep evangelicals frightened enough that they'll get to the polls and vote for him. They don't like him, so they're either going to set it out or they're going to go Republican because they are fearful of the Democrats.
Christine, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Christine Wicker's new book is The Fall of the Evangelical Nation, The Surprising Crisis Inside the Church. Jeff Charlotte's new book is called The Family, and in it he examines evangelical politicians who belong to a group called The Fellowship, or more simply, The Family. Charlotte agrees with Christine Wicker's revised stats on evangelicals, but he thinks that evangelical Christianity works its influence on the country's most powerful politicians in less transparent ways, below the media's radar.
Family is this international network of elite Christian conservative activists concentrated in military, government, and business. They really believe that if you are wealthy, if you're powerful, God's chosen you, and that's who they want to minister to. And as a result, they've always had a certain tension with the kind of the populist fundamentalist movement of radio religion and mass rallies and televangelists. They tend to look upon the James Dobsons and the Jerry Falwells as kind of tacky, as outsider movements, mass movements, whereas the family sees themselves as insiders. And I think have a much more sophisticated understanding of how political influence can work. And over the long term, I think a much more sophisticated understanding of how to work the media.
Now, bear with me. I'm about to read you a list. The Masons, the Illuminati, the Trilateral Commission, the CIA, Skull and Bones, the Jews. The idea of shadowy networks wielding secret power has fascinated partisans and paranoics across the political spectrum forever.
Mm-hmm.
But you were actually able to infiltrate the family because it's hidden in plain sight?
I wasn't so much able to infiltrate as I kind of walked in through the front door several years ago because I write about religion. A friend asked me to talk to her brother, whom she was afraid had joined a cult. And that was my introduction. I moved on from there to Wheaton College, an evangelical college west of Chicago, where the family had dumped 600 boxes of documents. So we don't have to get involved in any kind of conspiratorial thinking. We can turn to this incredible documentary record, as well as the interviews I was able to do with members of the family like Senator Sam Brownback, Representative Frank Wolf, Senator Mark Pryor.
You first wrote about the family something like 4 years ago in a long piece in Harper's Magazine that was just jaw-dropping. And yet, it seems to me in the intervening time, it hasn't gotten a lot of traction. You're just not reading about the family elsewhere. Why do you suppose that is?
The media recognizes fundamentalism and religious activism when it comes in these very stereotypical roles, whereas the elite fundamentalist tradition doesn't look like what Americans think fundamentalists are, going all the way back to 1925 when H.L. Mencken set the mold with his description of these sort of hillbilly Bible thumpers at the Scopes Monkey Trial. More recently, in the Washington Post, which dismissed fundamentalists as largely ignorant and easily led and poor rural people. And that just doesn't describe the elite part of the movement.
Could it be that the press, sort of as an institution, have looked at this and decided that the family exists, but it's more like an extremely elite prayer group?
The press does look at the family's only public event every year, which is something called the National Prayer Breakfast, which is the dullest, blandest, most ecumenical event in America, and concludes that there's really nothing going on here. And they don't really ask very many questions. But recently, a sociologist named D. Michael Lindsay, Rice University, published a book with Oxford University Press. He interviews 350 top political leaders, congressmen, two former presidents, who describe themselves as evangelical, and asks them, what group do they see as most influential in Washington? One in three names the family, or the fellowship, as it's also called, which is more than respond for any other group, more than identify James Dobson's focus on the family or Tony Perkins' Family Research Council. That should be a story.
So why is the press so skittish about asking the questions that need to be asked? Does it have to do with being uncomfortable, being perceived as treading on other people's faith?
I think that's part of it. I remember a real good case study of this was when John Ashcroft took office as attorney general, and you saw a lot of profiles about Ashcroft. And a lot of them noted his weekly morning prayer breakfast. And they would just note that and stop there and not ask any further questions. Now, to me, that's not a conspiratorial question. I want to know, well, what are your theological influences? When JFK gave his famous speech talking about his understanding of the relationship of his Catholicism to his decision-making, that should have pretty much ended the questions there. He had told us how it was going to affect his decision-making. When Senator Sam Brownback, on the other hand, a current senator from Kansas, declares that his faith teaches him that he has only one constituent, and it's Jesus. And when it comes down to a tough decision, he has to think about what Jesus wants. That becomes a very legitimate issue to explore. And the press needs to do a better job at exploring religious ideas.
Jeff, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Jeff Charlotte is an associate research scholar at the NYU Center for Religion and Media and the author of The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. In less than a month, Rush Limbaugh will celebrate his 20th year hosting The Rush Limbaugh Show. Rush is easily the most successful radio broadcaster with an audience of at least 14 million people a week. He just signed a $400 million 8-year re-up of his contract, making as much as all of the nightly news anchors combined. His political clout remains strong, fresh off of Operation Chaos, in which he convinced Republicans to vote for Hillary Clinton in order to prolong the bruising Democratic nomination fight. And he hangs out with Supreme Court justices. But 14 years after Limbaugh was credited with ushering in the Republican Revolution and the contract with America, is he still capable of swaying a presidential election? Zev Chaffetz has written about Limbaugh for this weekend's New York Times Magazine, and he joins us now. Zev, welcome to OTM.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Okay, first question. You are representing the New York Times, the apotheosis of the Eastern liberal media elite. How the hell did you get in to see Rush Limbaugh?
I asked nicely and persistently.
Limbaugh did get his backup with you when you persistently questioned him about his clout. Is it your belief that, in fact, he has begun to lose impact, maybe to the likes of Sean Hannity or Michael Savage or any of the right-wing screamers?
I talked to Michael Harrison, who's the publisher of Talkers Magazine, which is the industry magazine, and he told me that Limbaugh retains his position. He described him as something of like a combination of Elvis and the Beatles as far as AM talk radio is concerned. Jay Nordlinger, who was the managing editor of the National Review, told me that when he was hiring guys out of college for the National Review, they would come in and say that they became conservatives by listening to Rush Limbaugh. So I think that maybe his impact is less across the spectrum than it is across generations. That he's been on for 20 years, there are already people who see him as sort of the inspiration for their conservative views and their children's conservative views.
Now, I want to come to the McCain issue, because in order to support McCain in the upcoming election, he will have to go after Obama.
Right.
And he has already complained on the air of how difficult it is to go after Obama, lest he be tarred with the R word.
Right.
And he's clearly concerned about this, but he's also forged a strategy. Can you tell me what that is?
He appointed his call screener, a guy whose name is James Golden, and he calls Bo Snerdly, who is an African-American, to be the official Obama criticizer. And, of course, this is done as a way of
laundering?
No. He's laughing at the media's sensitivities. You know, I asked him specifically, I said, are you going to have a problem with an African-American candidate? And he said, no, you know, Obama's a liberal and I'll criticize him as a liberal, which is what he does.
Your piece on Limbaugh was very generous, I would say even flattering. You seem to give him a pass for his excesses. And when I'm talking about excesses, I'm talking about ad hominem attacks, truly mean-spirited stuff that goes way beyond satire and into the politics of vilification, and also playing fast and loose with the truth, seizing on some news item and grossly misrepresenting it, and creating a lot of hubbub, using as the kernel of his satire something that is just fundamentally untrue.
Well, do you have an example of that? I'm not an apologist for Rush Limbaugh, but I'm a little bit defensive because I think that the liberal media takes such an unfair view of him. I hear people being vilified on the radio, on all sorts of radio stations, by all sorts of people all day long. And Limbaugh is not worse than many of the ones I hear even on NPR. He just has a different point of view.
The NAACP should have a riot rehearsal. They should get a liquor store and practice robberies.
Not my sense of humor, but it's not a lie.
Did Limbaugh not say that Abu Ghraib was no worse than a skull and bones initiation?
Yeah, he did. It's his opinion.
Yeah. Did he not deny that genocide was committed against the American Indian and state that the population is higher now than it was before Christopher Columbus of Native Americans?
I don't know. I didn't ask him that either. I don't know what the population was before Christopher Columbus.
Yeah, it was about 15 million. And yeah, by the 19th century, it was 250,000. I mean, that's the numbers. Okay, now, I know you don't want to be an apologist for Rush Limbaugh or his spokesman.
Right.
But do you not think that he is answerable for things that are at minimum offensive and obnoxious and mean-spirited that he has said on the air?
Yeah, you know, I do think that. I think he's answerable to the public. And I think that for people who find him more obnoxious and more mean-spirited than other people that they prefer to listen to, then they should answer him by turning him off. I wouldn't say that I see Limbaugh as an unmixed, you know, blessing, but I do think that it's good for the American media climate to have at least one very strong conservative Republican voice that is heard, you know, across the country. There's more than one today, but they're all there only because Limbaugh was the first.
Well, Zev, I appreciate your time.
Hey, you're very welcome.
Zev Chaffetz wrote about the 20th Limbaughversary for the New York Times Magazine. Coming up, goat gonads and baby chicks, the bread and butter of U.S.-Mexican border radio. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, whose knowledge center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. At Esquire, The Village Voice, The Short-Lived New West, The Short-Lived Manhattan, Inc., and the even shorter-lived East Side Express, Clay Felker was one of the most successful and unsuccessful editors of the 20th century. Known best for creating New York Magazine in 1968, he not only struck a template that would inform scores of both monthly city magazines and alt-weeklies, he also cultivated a galaxy of journalism stars, Nicholas Pileggi, Dick Schaap, Mimi Sheraton, and Tom Wolfe among them. He also discovered me, sort of, hidden in plain sight at USA Today. Late in his career, Felker hired me to do humor columns for Adweek magazine. Those pieces were, let's say, ordinary, but when I was offered a job to write a feature column for rival Ad Age, Felker spent a whole night trying to talk me out of it. I listened carefully and then took the job, a gig that led to parallel careers as advertising critic and, never mind the details, radio journalist. So, I suppose Felker was wrong. But as so often in his storied career, he was wrong with a passion. Clay Felker died Tuesday. He was 82. For half of the 20th century, beginning in the early 30s, radio in the United States faced some of its fiercest competition from high-powered stations operating just south of the border. Known as border blasters or X stations, they offered a refuge for renegade broadcasters looking to evade regulation and, sometimes, the cops. Capitalizing on Mexico's willingness to look the other way, some of the strangest characters ever to grace the airwaves drew millions of fans from the American heartland and around the world. They also changed the shape of American broadcasting. On the Media's own Jamie York first told this story in November 2007.
Turn your radio on, turn your radio on, and listen to the music in the air.
If you were lucky enough to own a new wireless radio receiver in 1923 in small town Milford, Kansas, there was only one local broadcaster speaking directly to you.
Get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Dr. John Brinkley, graduate of the Eclectic Medical School in Chicago, had recently opened a clinic downtown, and he'd also started one of the first radio stations in the Midwest. Brinkley wasn't only a broadcasting pioneer, he was enjoying runaway success with a medical procedure he'd invented.
One of the first
patients, he had no sexual vigor left. He was flat as a tire.
Bill Crawford is co-author of a history titled Border Radio.
Dr. Brinkley, looking out his window with this patient in his office, kind of jokingly saw a Toggenburg goat and joked with his patient, "Boy, if you had some of them glands in you, you wouldn't have this problem at all." And according to Dr. Brinkley, the patient said, "Put them in me, doc. Put them in me. I need those goat glands."
Brinkley installed the goat gonads in his patient, and 9 months later, his wife gave birth to a boy. They named him Billy. The goat gland procedure was a sensation. President Lyndon Johnson, who grew up in the heyday of border radio, was recorded joking about it.
"You got the authority, you got the power, you got the money. Now, you may not have the glands."
"The glands?"
"Yeah.
I got plenty of glands."
"All right. I need Dr. Brinkley myself."
"Yeah.
Some of those goat glands."
Desperate patients arrived on Brinkley's doorstep daily to pay $750 for their piece of the goat. Among them was Los Angeles Times publisher and early radio broadcaster Harry Chandler. He inspired Brinkley to launch his own radio station, to entertain his patients, and to create more of them.
"You're again listening to the voice of Dr. J.R. Brinkley out of the Brinkley Hospitals, and you know you're sick. You know your prostate's infected and diseased, and you know that unless some relief comes to you, that you're going to be in the undertaker's parlor on the old cold slab being embalmed for a funeral."
He invited listeners to write in with their maladies, which he diagnosed on the air, recommending patent medicines in stock at Midwestern pharmacies, with whom he split the profits. That is, until the American Medical Association convinced the fledgling Federal Radio Commission to yank his broadcasting license.
And about that time, Brinkley received a letter from the Chamber of Commerce in Del Rio, Texas, inviting him to come down and build a radio station across the river from Del Rio in Old Mexico, in a town at that time which was called Villa Acuña, a very, very tiny border-crossing town.
Mexico was chafing against broadcast rules negotiated by the United States and Canada in the late 1920s that seized most of the valuable spectrum for themselves. Mexico saw in Brinkley an opportunity to stick it to their greedy neighbors.
"There is a saying, the border radio stations are the stick most useful to beat Washington."
Dr. Jose Ortiz is professor of communications at Pan American University in Mexico City. He says Brinkley's timing was impeccable. Mexico embraced the broadcasting outlaw with open arms.
"And Mexican government said, okay, to have the same station that had been closed down because of what you were doing in Kansas, do it here. You will have no problems with us."
Brinkley's station was licensed at 500,000 watts, 10 times more powerful than the most powerful station licensed in the United States. But it was built to blast at twice that. Brinkley's station and its message that you're only as old as your glands could be jacked up to 1 million watts of radiated power. Locals saw it electrocute birds in mid-flight. Electric lights would turn on by themselves. It could be picked up on barbed wire fences and bed springs. The physics of AM radio ensured that border radio had no borders.
"From coast to coast, border to border, wherever you are, wherever you may be, when you think of real fine entertainment, think of XERL."
When you crank up these transmitters to super high powers at night, the signals actually go up and they bounce off the ionosphere. So you can see that they would cover the globe. They're doing this and hitting points all over the Earth. We have people who heard them on ships in the South Pacific, people who heard them in Scandinavia. We heard tales that the KGB in Moscow tuned into XERF to learn the English language.
In America, most radio in the late 20s and 30s was still dominated by the big cities on the coast, trafficking in light sophistication like orchestral or big band music and family-friendly dramas. Brinkley opened the world's most powerful station to what his patients wanted to hear— performers from vaudeville, carnivals, or old-time medicine shows.
"That means you're listening to XERF via Acuña, Coahuila in the Republic of Mexico, your cleared channel station that covers every state in the nation. And howdy do, friends and neighbors."
This was the era where people were really figuring out that radio and the broadcasting media was a one-on-one media. This was the era where FDR figured out about the fireside chats.
But, says Crawford, border radio circumvented government or corporate control over the media.
It was programming that spoke directly to the farmer in the Dust Bowl to the small town merchant in Minneapolis. It was programming that went direct to the heart of the American people, and it sounded a whole lot more interesting to them than what they could get from the regular radio stations.
Brinkley had struck upon the mainstays of border radio programming: health, sex, music, and religion. Preaching became a staple, and radio stations got a cut of the preacher's profits.
Meet me on my knees, on your knees, Friday night at 7:30. And listen now, my friends, the prayer tower is open. The prayer tower is open right now. You that need prayer, my God, the prayer team are sitting by the telephones right now to pray.
In the early 30s, most religious broadcasting was banned by the national radio networks, and asking for money was strictly forbidden. But not on border radio. Preachers pulled in ears, and that boosted sales of all kinds of products, like baby chicks.
But right now, friends, the famous Allied Hatchery is offering you listeners 100 of the regular $5.95 baby chicks. For only $4.95 per 100 if you get your order in right away. Now at this
the always
price,
popular chicks created a kind of hostage situation at post offices across the country.
Roy Acuff said he went into the post office to mail some letters on a tour one time, and he heard all of these chickens in there for people to pick up. They sent them COD, I guess. You had to pay to get them out.
Dallas Turner was a border radio personality for over 40 years as a yodeler, a singing cowboy, a mentalist, and a pitchman.
Boy, we sold everything that you can think of. You know, I sold false teeth by mail, aphrodisiacs, erection enhancers, feminine hygiene equipment, with the free enema attachments because you ordered before midnight tomorrow night, Lonely Hearts Clubs, hemorrhoid medicine, erectile itch formula. And believe it or not,
in this age of atomic weapons, worry, and stress, scientific research has produced a substance to help calm and soothe worried and nervous people. Such a substance is in the sleep aid Restall.
Brinkley helped the pitching go down easier with some of the most influential performers ever in country music. Jimmy Rogers, Bill Monroe, and Woody Guthrie all did stints on border radio. And the first family of country music, the Carter family, spent winters at Brinkley Station. This is where Johnny Cash first heard his future wife, June Carter, while listening to the radio in Arkansas.
Every day it will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny sky of love.
Now, the Carter family wants to know when you're coming down to Monterey. And the custom authorities will do everything possible to cut all the red tape, make it easy for you to get across the border.
Like a magnet, border radio drew money, followed by a steady stream of performers, outcasts, entrepreneurs, and fugitives. Norman Baker was a faux doctor claiming to cure cancer with his laying on of hands. Baker also broadcasted medical hokum and anti-conglomeration screeds from his high-wattage station KTNT Know the Naked Truth in Muscatine, Iowa. Following run-ins with medical and radio regulators, Baker, like Brinkley, decamped to the border and built himself a blaster station.
He dressed all in purple. And one way he got inspired in the broadcasting booth was to put a bed in there, and he would lie down in the bed with his paramour, Madame Tangley, and make love while speaking over the radio about the evils of the radio networks. It puts all the shock jocks right in their place. Pikers, mere pikers.
Like other dishonored entrepreneurs before and since, both Brinkley and Baker had run for office. Both lost before heading to the border. But in the 1930s, one business-minded broadcaster finally won. W. Lee Pappy passed the biscuits O'Daniels. Depicted in the film, A Brother Where Art Thou.
We ain't one at a time in here. We're mass communicating.
Oh, yeah.
The real O'Daniels sold flour in Texas, where he reluctantly agreed to sponsor a country music group on the radio.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful Texas. Where the beautiful bluebonnets roll.
The group, including future country star Bob Wills, was a hit, and O'Daniels grabbed the mic to plug his flower. He never let go, riding his folksy flower-pitching popularity to two terms as Texas governor. Governor O'Daniels had electrical transcriptions made of his addresses and flower ads made in the statehouse for broadcast from a border blaster he co-owned in Mexico. In 1941, O'Daniels ran for Senate in a race that included two other border radio moguls and a congressman, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Pappy won again, dealing LBJ his only electoral loss.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen, and hello there, boys and girls. This is your United States Senator, W. Lee O'Daniel of Texas, speaking to you from your nation's capital, Washington, D.C., and sending you...
By the 1950s, border radio was struggling with competition from television, with legal troubles. When Brinkley finally lost a station during World War II, it was amidst rumors that it had been infiltrated by Axis powers broadcasting propaganda. But just as it was faltering, it was resurrected by an unlikely Brooklyn boy named Bob Smith.
And for those of you who want to dig on the Wolfman tomorrow night, I'll be back here, same stand, man, right here on the big XCRB, 50,000-watt clear channel.
Smith had run away from home to be a DJ, and he eventually made his way to the border stations he'd heard as a kid. The Wolfman played rhythm and blues, so-called race music, exotic for a lot of white listeners. And he sounded like rock and roll. Arriving on the dial starting at midnight, his howl sounded like nothing else.
You definitely gonna find the action over there because you're gonna be able to dance, rock and roll, carry on, and also find yourself somebody who is deeply in love with you, man.
People didn't know whether he was black, he was white, he was Mexican, or that he was Martian. It was just a continuous weird blast, and it was wild. It was fascinating.
Among the fascinated, a young George Lucas. His film American Graffiti would be about the influence of the Wolfman on a generation of California teenagers.
I just loved listening to Wolfman. My mom won't let me at home because he's a Negro. I think he's terrific. Do you know that he just broadcasts from a plane that flies around in circles?
The Wolfman sold record collections. He sold roach clips for catching little baby roaches, pills and patent medicines, and yes, baby chicks.
Imagine all the fun you're going to have with these little babies. You just lead them around on little leashes. You give them little names. And then, of course, as they grow up and comes wintertime, you cook them and eat them. It's going to be just fun for you.
The Wolfman eventually wound up in Hollywood. And though border radio saw a new crop of preachers and pitchmen, the writing was on the wall. Its broadcasts in English were over by the 1980s. Bill Crawford says that whenever he hears someone condemning the so-called media elites, whenever he listens to pop music, whenever he gets Viagra spam mail, when he hears morning zoo DJs during drive time, he hears the echoes of border radio.
Border radio pioneered popularizing American popular music, country music, rock and roll, hillbilly, gospel music. Border radio gave a place where your outspoken men of vision, both religious and political, had a place to let their vision be heard before it was allowed on the regular media.
For over 50 years, border radio was the embodiment of Mexican anger at its neighbors to the north. But it paid off. Mexico finally got what it wanted, the right to broadcast to itself. Most of the former border blaster transmitters are now Mexican, broadcasting for Mexicans. They no longer need to punish the U.S. with the likes of Dr. Brinkley, Norman Baker, and Wolfman Jack. But Bill Crawford says that doesn't mean we've seen the last of the renegades.
All of these things come back again and resurface. They resurface in the internet, and they continue resurfacing whenever new forms of communication, whenever new media are pioneered and allowed to run free.
Border radio was a legal loophole, a fluke. And yet somewhere, the next loophole is opening up, and the entrepreneurs, entertainers, and outlaws are waiting to walk right through. For On the Media, I'm Jamie York.
When I get to reminiscing, I always get to missing those sweet money-making days.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited this week by Consensus. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield. I was rolling in the money.
I had a ball on border radio.
Hi, this is Katya Rogers, senior producer of OTM. In a few weeks' time, we'll be airing a show all about investigative reporting, the history, the future, and some of the quirks of this vital part of journalism. In one interview, Brooke looks at the representation of reporters in the movies, and that got us to thinking. We want to hear from you about your favourite fictional journalists in books. With summer upon us, who will you be taking to the beach? Will it be Michael Connelly's crime reporter Jack McAvoy, or Edna Buchanan's Britt Montero, or John Cotton in the novel Fly on the Wall? There are so many out there. Email us at onthemedia.org, put summer reading as the subject, and we'll compile a top 10 for your beach reading pleasure. Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.